Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This Court should reverse the District Court's grant of habeas relief with respect to Mr. Ben Israel's Porter County convictions and sentence. And this is true because the District Court's decision to grant the relief in this case is not based on an unreasonable application of United States Supreme Court precedent or a misapplication of federal law. Rather, I think with respect to the District Court, it granted relief in this case because it would have reached a different conclusion than did the Indiana Supreme Court on these issues. And the state Supreme Court's adjudication was clearly reasonable. First and foremost, with respect to the claim that the prosecutor improperly commented on the petitioner's failure to testify, what happened in that instance was that, well, I have to preface that by characterizing the nature of the state's case and petitioner's case in general, which was the state's case primarily consisted of confessions to these crimes that were given by petitioner. And in opening statements, the state made it clear that it was going to rely heavily on those confessions and that it was going to present much evidence to show that they were properly obtained and the petitioner gave them voluntarily and willingly. In response, in opening, defense told the jury that, in fact, there would be much evidence presented and that they would show, well, rather the state would portray the circumstances under which the confessions were obtained in its way with its witnesses, and that they would then show with other witnesses a different account of how that came to be and focus quite a bit on the time that it took for the authorities to bring petitioner before the magistrate, urging an inference from that that there was some kind of subtle coercion employed. Ultimately, in closing, when the comment at issue occurred, the prosecutor had been summing up that the defense had not, as it said it would in opening, shown that there was a coerced or that there were coercive tactics employed to obtain these confessions.
Right, and if he had stopped there, that would have been fine, but he went way beyond that, didn't he? When you look at the discussion between the court and counsel, the court said don't get into this whole question of him commenting on his failure to testify, and the prosecutor just forged ahead.
That's, Your Honor, that's true. The prosecutor, unfortunately, chose his words poorly. And the record shows that he immediately was aware of that. As he made the comment, trial counsel for the petitioner objected, moved for mistrial, and immediately the prosecutor, in the presence of the jury, corrected his unfortunate choice of words and said, let the defense show you. And at that point, after some discussion between the parties and the court reserved its ruling on the motion for a mistrial. Ultimately, it denied it. But the Indiana Supreme Court, in analyzing this claim, determined that throughout the trial, the state had referred to petitioner as, or as to the defense, rather, as defendant. The district court relied on accounting of instances where reference to the defendant personally or the defense was made and kind of did a numbers analysis because he found that, I think, if I'm correct, Your Honor, 62 references.
Right, to the defendant.
And five counsel. To the defense in general. We don't necessarily agree with the district court's characterization of each and every one of those because, for one thing, we don't agree that that kind of a counting of references is the proper way to adjudicate this claim.
Well, I think the court said it was 56 of the inferences. It's 56 times that he referred personally to the defendant petitioner and maybe five times to the defense attorney.
So I wouldn't disagree with that, Your Honor.
Right.
The Indiana Supreme Court, though, did not analyze it in that way. Rather, the Indiana Supreme Court looked at the context when it occurred and the fact that the state had referred to the defense as defendant. and what actually occurred in the exchange and determined that it was not an intentional reference to the defendant personally for failing to take the stand. And I think that U.S. v. Robinson is the case on point with respect to this claim, and not Griffin and Carter and Doyle, which were the cases that were looked at by the district court.
But isn't there, even if it was unintentional, I mean, isn't there a point where the cumulative effect certainly is prejudicial in terms of having a prejudicial impact on the jury?
There could be that point. And the Indiana Supreme Court reasonably found that it didn't happen here. And, Your Honor, I think the reason why an indirect reference like this wasn't prosecutorial misconduct was because the defense had urged an inference.
Now, they did. I understand, Mr. Martin, your position that it's a comment on the defense theory, right?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor.
But let us focus for a second, if we could, on the context. And as I understand this, the critical language that that may be in part involved, at least, let the defendant tell you why somebody would freely voluntarily confess. That's the misspoken phrase that you feel it would obviously have been better let the defense tell you.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, whether that's spoken in a rhetorical sense or not, when was that comment made?
Closing argument, Your Honor.
What part of closing argument? Rebuttal, right? Or opening?
I think it was opening, Your Honor.
You sure it's opening?
I'm not sure.
Well, you see, that's, to me, a critical issue, because how, if it's in rebuttal and not opening, I'm not suggesting sandbagging, but I am suggesting if it's rebuttal that there's no opportunity to quote the defense to respond, right?
That's true, Your Honor, but again, in the context of closing argument, the jury was also aware of the fact that there was not going to be more testimony, and the prosecutor wouldn't have been referring to the defendant taking the stand literally in the context of that comment.
Yeah, but as I read the appendix here, it looks to me like we're talking about the rebuttal of the close, not the opening.
I don't specifically recall, Your Honor, so if that's what you're...
Well, but you see, it does, for me at least, give me concern about when defense counsel can reply to the theory or defend the theory of the as it is raised by in closing argument. I mean, because otherwise, it's asking a question that can't be responded to unless the juror reach back and.
And I, of course, I can't disagree with Your Honor on that point. There's not another opportunity procedurally for a defendant to speak to it.
What concerns me is that maybe that you don't know, because if it were in rebuttal and then you could point to something in the defendant's counsel's own closing that made something of it that this would respond to, perhaps, then that might give some justification for saying it. Or if it were in the opening, then that would give the defense counsel an opportunity. So it would perhaps mitigate. The thing that confuses me, frankly, is that nobody seems to emphasize that there was an express instruction given to the jury, which is not always the case in a criminal trial or anything else. That saying, and I can't put my finger on it, but there are three full sentences in an instruction saying that they cannot take into consideration the fact that the defendant did not take the stand. Now, with this implication that he might take the stand to explain why he signed and made all these confessions and then quickly corrected, that's kind of an implication. It would seem that it would be possible that the express instruction that admonishes the jury forbids them from taking that into consideration should be sufficient. But nobody seems to argue this.
Your Honor, I believe that I have pointed out that they've been so instructed.
Well, you might have mentioned it in the brief. but nobody makes a big deal out of it. And I'm not sure that Indiana Supreme, other than setting it out, said that that was given, which is what alerted me to it.
Related to that, though, Your Honor, the Indiana Supreme Court also found that if this were, in fact, error, which they did not agree that it was, it would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
But not because they were specifically and expressly forbidden to take it into consideration. They didn't say that, or I don't see where...
They did not expressly
discuss it. And I guess I'm just wondering why, and maybe I'm just wrong. I'm the one up here who has not tried a criminal case, so...
Well, I would agree with you, Your Honor, that definitely has a strong influence on how this should be looked at. However, the Indiana Supreme Court didn't expressly discuss it in those terms, as you pointed out. So I would just like to talk to the court a little bit about why the Indiana court or the Indiana Supreme Court's determination that it was harmless was correct.
Well, before you get to that, though, shouldn't the district court have given a curative instruction at the time the statement was made? There was no instruction given at the time, was it? I could have missed it.
There was not, Your Honor. And the only thing that I can surmise from that is that possibly the district court found, the trial court, found that that would have called more undue attention to the occurrence.
But there wasn't even any discussion, was it, in the record, of whether curative instruction should have been given at the time?
There was a request for one.
And the defendant. And the trial court denied it. So
yes.
Isn't it normally defense counsel who makes that assessment as to whether or not a curative instruction should be given at the time?
Well,
often what happens is something will come in, some statement is made that's objectionable. Defense counsel then gets to make that judgment as to whether they want a curative instruction. The court denied that opportunity here. That could have cured it, or at least perhaps could have gone a long way to cure it and certainly put you in a stronger position if it had been given then rather than at the conclusion of the trial.
That's true, Your Honor, but perhaps the trial court felt that the better course was to give the instruction at the conclusion rather than doing it contemporaneously with the occurrence.
But we don't have anything from the trial court knowing what the
we don't have an explanation of its
thinking
rationale.
Was or assessment. It was just a straight up denial of the request. Correct.
In the context of the harmless error, the district court determined that the Indiana Supreme Court had unreasonably come to that conclusion because the district court felt that it could not in any way, shape, or form consider the two confessions that petitioner had given to the murders that he was charged with in this case. And that's clearly, he offered no authority for proceeding in that fashion. It's clearly erroneous. And when one considers the confessions along with the other evidence, it's clearly overwhelming. And in that context, it certainly was not an unreasonable adjudication for the Indiana Supreme Court to conclude that the state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the prosecutor's reference was harmless.
Did the confessions, at least as I read them, I didn't see it. Is there somewhere in the confessions, maybe I haven't seen all of it, where he makes any reference to any other persons participating in this?
He does not, Your Honor. He does not acknowledge the presence or participation of others.
Either McGee or Harris?
He does not implicate them in his confessions.
Is there some reason why he wouldn't? And you explain why he wouldn't, just out of curiosity. Was there some reason he's covering up for them or making the rap himself, or is this just irrational, or what?
There is no indication of his motive for taking the blame and not sharing it with them, Your Honor. It just appears from the record that he was unwilling to, for lack of a better term, snitch on his accomplices when the converse was not true on their part.
Clearly, the witness who faked getting killed, when he was shot at and missed, I forget her name, but she
Carrie
heard
Jones.
Someone else was obviously right there talking to the shooter.
Correct.
So there's obviously another person involved in that one.
And in that case, Ronald Harris was the shooter, Your Honor.
Yeah, but we don't know who the other guy was.
Correct. We just know that he had someone with him. But the confessions did corroborate the other evidence and vice versa with respect to the victims, where they were shot, both in terms of in the area where they were shot and in terms of where on their persons they were shot. The use of the white Nissan to go to the locations where the crimes occurred. And there was also evidence admitted that as petitioner's counsel pointed out in the last case, there was no ballistics match to the shotgun with the evidence that was recovered from the Hudson gas station and the Howard Johnson's murders. But the wadding and the pellets that were recovered from the bodies in the autopsy were consistent in color and size and type to those that were used at the Belovsky murder scene.
When you make reference to the white Nissan, I only recall one reference to it, and that is that it was apparently stolen and someone was driving it, and then two others were in the other car. Do you recall something like that?
That's an account of what happened with the South Lake Mall incident that resulted.
I bring that up only to indicate that there had to be three people.
In that instance, we had Antoine McGee and we had Petitioner that were involved in that ATM robbery at South Lake Mall. In the course of those events, Petitioner carjacked a silver Nissan, not his white Nissan that was used in the other murders.
I see. Okay.
The web of facts in this case is exceedingly confusing at times, Your Honor, and it's difficult to sort them all out, but one thing is clear. The petitioner was implicated in the deaths of 11 people, and true, he was acquitted in two previous trials, and that is due to the fact that there was such strong testimony identifying Harris as the principal in those acts.
But in terms of whether or not the error was harmless or not, I mean, some of the evidence that the state relied on, like the 12-gauge shotgun, that some witnesses testified they saw the defendant with the shotgun, but the one found in the closet wasn't the same shotgun, was it?
Yes.
Used in these murders?
Yes,
it was. Same one? Did the shell casings match?
But, Your Honor, that's kind of what, and I didn't explain it very well. That the shell casings that was found at the Lake County murder of the Belovsky brothers at the tailor shop, that matched to the shotgun that was found in Petitioner's apartment. The wadding and ballistics evidence other than the shell that could be matched was similar to, in many respects, that which was recovered from the victims' bodies in the Porter County case. There was no ballistics match of any evidence from the Porter County murders to the shotgun, but it was an inference that was strongly supported there because you have a match in the Lake County case and it was recovered in Petitioner's
but there apartment. There's no ability to match that unless you have a casing, which they had because he shot twice.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
There's no way you can. It's not like being able to find the spirals in the barrel or the ballistics. It's the same type of ammunition.
And no distinguishing marks from the firing pin, et cetera. That's correct, Your Honor. However, the evidence that was presented was overwhelming. The confessions should not have been discounted, and the Indiana Supreme Court properly did not discount them in concluding that this comment by the prosecutor was harmless. Similarly, Judge Sharp granted relief with respect to the condition of the record on appeal. This, again, does not evidence an unreasonable application of controlling United States Supreme Court precedent or that it's contrary to any such holding. And the Indiana Supreme Court, much is made of this allegation that petitioner didn't have an opportunity to make sure that the record was sufficient for his needs on appeal and to receive meaningful appellate review. And I think that point is conclusively mooted by the Indiana Supreme Court's examination of the record and examination for how it might have curtailed his ability to raise claims on appeal from the post-conviction review. So, in fact, the Indiana Supreme Court did examine the, I believe it was a 61-page listing of errors in the record that petitioner was concerned about, and the court addressed them. So the contention that he didn't get an opportunity just kind of falls moot.
I know you've got to, I'm going to take another question here just because I want to explore one thing. The necessity of bringing in the, we'll call it the brothers or the tailor shop or whatever,
yes,
trial in this one. Apparently it was a mini trial within a trial on this other case. Is that right?
That's a fair
point. Now, that brings in the implication about Fleming again, doesn't it? And whether he should have been called for as a witness in that trial, which apparently they were aware of him at that point, weren't they?
Well, if...
Or were they?
Aware of
in
Fleming?
Porter, in Porter County.
Apparently, I don't know what counsel's awareness was of Fleming at that time. I do know this, Your Honor, that in the Porter County cases, I know that all concerned were aware of the fact that Ronald Harris had already admitted to being with petitioner at the Hudson Station when that murder occurred. So to present Fleming's testimony in the context of the Porter County murders would not have been persuasive in terms of an acquittal for this petitioner, because the state could have, for the limited purpose of rebutting that, placed Harris on the stand to offer that information to the jury.
And so I guess in that case, then, it would just imply that he was there with Peterson.
Correct, Your Honor.
The previous time. So that there would be a difference in not calling him there than in the other case, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Evans?
The district court properly granted habeas corpus on two grounds in this case. First, the comment on petitioner's failure to testify. As the state just highlighted for you, and in the defense counsel's closing statement, the prosecutor's closing statement, the prosecutor said the cornerstone of their case was defendant's confession. And that's exactly why Mr. Ben-Yisrael was prejudiced by the prosecutor's comments here. Only Mr. Ben-Yisrael could explain why he confessed to these crimes. His counsel could explain the circumstances, but the reason for his confession was exclusively his own. And the fact that the confessions were the cornerstone of their case shows that Mr. Ben-Yisrael was prejudiced by his failures.
Now, Ms. Huggins, do you know when it occurred in the record?
It was in the opening.
Opening.
But
the opening of the close?
Yes.
So the defense lawyer got up afterward?
But if the defense lawyer had mentioned it again in their closing argument, it would have only highlighted the fact that Mr. Ben-Yisrael had confessed and then not taken the stand. And the clear import of the prosecutor's statement...
You're sure it's in the opening, not the rebuttal?
Reasonably sure.
Okay. I'm just working off the appendix that you submitted.
Yes, sir.
And... it seems to end with that argument, but it may well be that it's abstracted in a fashion. But I'll work for a second off the presumption that the defense got a chance to get up. The defense counsel got a chance to get up, although I don't have that. State apparently didn't choose to supplement it. It seems of some moment to me, but not perhaps to anyone else. But on that point, then, that maybe the defense counsel, if it happened in the opening of the close, not the rebuttal. The defendant was interrupted in mid-sentence. I mean, prosecutor was interrupted in mid-sentence.
Yes, but after the damage had been done.
Well, but he seeks to correct it by saying defendant's counsel can say why a person can confess to a crime. I mean, there is the misspoken and inappropriate reference to defendant. But... Within seconds of the objection for mistrial, he says defendant's counsel can say why a person
confess to a crime. The jury would have already heard the impermissible comment.
I understand that.
And secondly,
I'm accepting that.
But the lawyers were speaking over each other when he apparently corrected himself, and it's unclear then what the jury would have made of that correction.
What of Judge Mannion's point about the instruction, the combination of the circumstances I'm pointing to and the suggestion that there's a curative instruction?
Well, as Judge Williams pointed out, the instruction wasn't immediately given, even though defense counsel had asked for an immediate, you know, admonishment. The court there refused to give it.
For the reason that it would just magnify what was just said.
And again, that highlights the fact that even if defense counsel had stood up and had a closing after, if they said anything about it, it would only highlight the fact that the prosecutor had made an impermissible comment.
Yeah. Well, the court says he didn't hear the whole statement because of the interruption. And I mean, it gets kind of confusing to try to recreate, at least on appeal, what exactly happened in that.
And if he'd asked for it, we'd probably have ineffective assistance of counsel in, huh?
Well, in addition, you know, if I could note that the trial record is in dispute in this case anyway, so it's the problems are highlighted in this case and magnified by the failures with respect to the court reporter. But in this case, it's clear that the prosecutor was asking the defendant to do something only he could do, that Mr. Ben Yisrael should have taken the stand to explain why he confessed to a crime that he didn't, and the fact that he didn't take the stand means that he's guilty. The state has said that throughout the trial, and the Indiana Supreme Court said this as well, that the prosecutor had referred to defendant to mean defense counsel. And I believe that if you look at the closing argument and you look at the references to defendant, it's clear that those references were to defendant, meaning Mr. Ben Yisrael and not his defense counsel. And the Indiana Supreme Court's finding otherwise was simply unreasonable in light of the facts in this case. For instance, immediately before the impermissible comments, he said defendant confessed. And certainly he didn't mean Mr. Ben Yisrael's counsel confessed to these crimes. He meant defendant, meaning Mr. Ben Yisrael individually.
What was that again? He said what?
If you step back from the statements, maybe I could start a quote from the prosecutor. He said, quote, "I told you in the opening statement that the defendant confessed to killing these four people with his shotgun. We proved that. We told you that was the cornerstone of our case and why. Because it is self-evident that no one freely..."
Well, actually, he said self-evidence, didn't he?
Right. I corrected it. I'm sorry. He said, "Because it is self-evidence that no one freely and voluntarily confesses to a murder unless they're guilty. Let the defendant tell you why somebody would freely and voluntarily confess to," at which time he was cut off by the objection.
So if he said defense, you wouldn't have a point. Is that right?
In this case,
if he said defense, it would speak to the theory of the case, wouldn't it?
I don't believe in this context, even if he had said defense, that it would speak to the theory of the case, because he'd immediately said before that, defendant confessed, only guilty people confess, and somebody could have taken the stand, and the only person who could take the stand and explain why he confessed to a crime he didn't commit is Mr. Ben Yisrael. No other person can do that for him.
Well, he suggests this is a voluntary confession. So what was challenged at trial with regard to the confession by the defense?
Defense counsel put forward two different challenges. First, they said that they did try to show that it was coerced or threatened in some way. But secondly, they said even if there was no coercion, even if there was no threat, it was untrue. So it wasn't just that defense counsel was trying to...
Well, that's the theory. It's a voluntary confession, but it's untrue. You don't think that's reasonable to raise? Why would anybody confess to a statement because it give a false statement like that? That could never be appropriate closing argument in a case.
Well, Mr. Ben Yisrael didn't testify at trial.
No, I'm talking about the confession was entered at trial. That was the evidence, right?
That was the evidence.
And if you have an acknowledgement by defense counsel or presentment of a presumption that assumed that it's voluntary, but it's untrue. Doesn't that kind of raising that suggestion allow for a fair comment on the illogical conclusions to be drawn from that statement?
I guess I need to clarify. Defense counsel didn't concede that it was voluntary.
I thought you said even if it was voluntary.
Well, they had argued alternatively, you know, even if the jury found that it was voluntary, that the facts showed that it was a false confession, that it was untrue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if the police didn't beat him to confess, for some reason he confessed to something he didn't do. And we know that that's true because Carrie Gilson testified that Mr. Ben Yisrael didn't kill Rhonda Hammersley, even though he said he'd acted alone in that case and shot Rhonda Hammersley.
Okay.
But that's the only challenged. There wasn't a suppression argument, et cetera, saying that this was involuntary in some determination. Obviously, this had to be fought well before trial. What went on? What was the challenge to the confessions?
The confession was admitted over
four trials. I guess in each case, I don't know whether they're redundant. Obviously, there are different judges in some of them. So, what was the challenge to the admission of the confession?
There was a challenge, a motion to suppress the confession on several grounds. One that comes up here, in fact, one was that Mr. Ben Yisrael should have been taken before a magistrate within 24 hours for a judicial determination of probable cause after his warrantless arrest, and that although the police should have taken him before the magistrate, instead they delayed his presentment in order to obtain more evidence, namely his confession.
Well,
that was one of the grounds.
One of the things that he wanted to sleep on it after talking with his mother, right?
That's what the police testified that he said.
Well, okay. I mean, and then they woke him up at 8:30 the next morning. Got a nude night's sleep, and then he proceeds to go through these series of confessions.
And the magistrate testified that in normal procedure, Mr. Ben Yisrael would have been taken before the magistrate at that time for an initial hearing. And the only reason that the police didn't take him before the magistrate was for the impermissible reason of trying to gather more evidence to convict Mr. Ben Yisrael.
But that's it. I mean, there's not a challenge that somehow coercion or starvation or something else other than the delay. Is there any basis that they were challenging things that wouldn't be admissible at trial if somebody, him or somebody, said, okay, they beat me or did this or that? Was there some challenge to this strange fact that he's confessed to all these murders?
There were multiple challenges, and I believe that defense counsel...
Was it because, other than the delay, was there something substantive that he was tortured or something? I mean, we've seen all that. A lot of times they come up with a lot of things. I just wondered what was used to challenge him.
There was no specific evidence that he was tortured, but as the state pointed out in their brief, defense counsel highlighted throughout the trial that his first day that he was detained, there's no tape recording of Mr. Ben Yisrael's conversations with the police. There's no videotape of it, and nothing was reduced to writing that whole first day. And that first day, it's important to remember that the morning of his first day of detention, McGee had already implicated him in the crimes. The shotgun had already been matched to the crime scenes. They had the evidence against Mr. Ben Yisrael, what happened the rest of that day. And defense counsel highlighted that fact throughout the trial. But there wasn't any specific evidence entered at the trial or before the trial showing that he was somehow beaten or coerced. So the Indiana Supreme Court, in addition to unreasonably determining that the prosecutor was commenting on defense counsel and not the defendant, also unreasonably concluded that the facts against that the prosecutor's statement, if impermissible, was harmless. And the state, again, has characterized the evidence as overwhelming against Mr. Ben Yisrael. But a couple of facts say otherwise. They said in their closing argument, the state, that the confession was the cornerstone of their case. That was their key piece of evidence. And if their case was so strong, then why did they have to have this mini-trial on the Bolovsky evidence? The fact is, the evidence was weak in this case. And if you look at, particularly with the Harshwan Dhaliwal case, witnesses presented by defense counsel show that there were two white men at the scene of the crime immediately before and immediately after Dhaliwal was killed. Those witnesses who were at the scene never reported seeing Mr. Ben Yisrael there. Moreover, the shotgun couldn't forensically be linked to the Dhaliwal or Meitzler murders. And the state has said here that there was a strong circumstantial case, but the state's argument assumes that the same person used the shotgun to commit all of these killings. And the state has obviously taken a contrary position in front of this court. In its opposition to our motion to consolidate these appeals, the state said that the shotgun killer wasn't a single person. They conceded that Ronald Harris may have shot some of these people, perhaps Mr. Ben Yisrael shot other of these people. If that's the case, then there is no strong circumstantial case to be made for ballistics matching at the Bolovsky scene and not and having no ballistics at the Dhaliwal and Meitzler scenes.
The only way, though, I'm not any ballistics expert, but for a shotgun, other than having the type of of ammunition used based on whatever they recover, if you don't have the casing that can specifically identify it with that particular weapon, there isn't any way to get a ballistic check, is there?
And that's precisely the problem here. There were shells found at the scenes in the first, second, and fourth trials, but the third trial, the Porter County trial, there were no shells at either of these scenes, so ballistics couldn't match the shotgun.
Mm.
In addition, the Indiana Supreme Court unreasonably determined that there were three witnesses who they say placed Mr. Ben-Yisrael at the scene of the Dhaliwal and Meitzler murders. In fact, the district court does a good job of analyzing the evidence of these witnesses. No one placed Mr. Ben-Yisrael at the scene of the crimes at the time of the shootings. The state presented one woman who said that she saw Mr. Ben-Yisrael a mile and a quarter from the scene of the Dhaliwal murder. You have another witness who said, I saw Mr. Ben-Yisrael at the scene of the Dhaliwal murder 2 days after it happened. And you have a third witness who said, I saw a black man and a white Nissan Sentra at the scene of the Marie Meitzler murder the day before that murder took place. And I think it's important to look at all of these factual inaccuracies of the Indiana Supreme Court, particularly in light of the fact that in their own opinion in this case, they even get the dates of the murders wrong in two different places. The record is a mess. The opinions are a mess. And I think that the district court properly granted relief.
The reasons he used the messed up record seemed to be paramount. That he looked at this and, of course, the statement of the prosecutor. There were other issues, remaining that he did not address. One of which is I guess it's still an issue of the bringing in the other trial evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that one of the challenges?
One is the admission of the extrinsic evidence.
Yeah,
of the
you had
murders.
Several more.
Yes.
That the district court didn't address. Now, if the first two at least may not be enough. But one of the others is. Does that have to be remanded and argued?
I don't believe it needs to be remanded with respect to the fourth and fifth issues. In addition to the inadequacy of the record and the comment by the prosecutor, we raised three other issues: the admission of extrinsic evidence, ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to Fleming, and also the unreasonable delay violating Mr. Ben-Yisrael's Fourth Amendment rights. Those the last two of those arguments were raised and considered by the district court with basically the same facts and the same law in the Lake County case. So I don't believe there'd be any benefit to remanding and having the district court again consider those issues in this case. I think judicial economy would be served on by not remanding and taking the record as it is and deciding those issues.
And I recognize it's hard to keep the facts straight of each of these cases, but in this one, didn't he confess to a friend about what had happened?
Antoine McGee testified. And again, we run into the same problems with Antoine McGee. Antoine McGee was a known associate of Ronald Harris, and the car driven by Antoine McGee at the time was seen by Patrick Fleming at the Blavatsky murders. So Patrick Fleming, had he testified, would have not only helped Mr. Ben-Yisrael to place the white man, Ronald Harris, at the scene, but he also would have given a reason for the jury to doubt Mr. McGee's testimony in this case. I would say that Mr. McGee is not a credible witness in this case. Moving to the inadequacy of the record, the state has argued that...
So let me just make sure I track that correctly. So Fleming was important for this case as well.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes. And that is the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that we raised in addition to the two claims that were ruled on by the district court.
Now, they say that if by bringing Fleming in, by that time they knew that Fleming and, I guess, Harris were close. Is that why they wouldn't bring him in?
Actually, the Porter County case was tried, this case, was tried before the Lake County case.
Oh.
So defense counsel was not aware at all of Patrick Fleming at either the Lake County or the Porter County proceedings. So they couldn't have moved forward with that approach, with that strategy.
So if they're going to bring in the other trial, then they've got to bring Of course, they weren't aware of him, were they?
They weren't aware of Fleming at that point.
So yes. Is there a cross appeal on the Fleming, the court's Fleming ruling?
It's our understanding that in this case, as the habeas appellee, and we're not seeking any additional relief beyond the habeas that was granted, it was unnecessary for us to file a cross appeal and likewise to obtain a certificate of appealability. When a habeas petitioner is appellee, that's unnecessary under Zosbo v. Walls. The Indiana Supreme Court and the state here have argued that petitioner had meaningful appellate review and that the Indiana Supreme Court had found on post-conviction that the errors did not prejudice Mr. Ben-Yisrael. The problem with that approach, though, is that there were things that are incomplete in this record, omissions in this record. And how is it that appellate counsel is to try to identify from missing portions of the record how they were prejudiced by those missing portions of the record without having the benefit of knowing what happened? You have, in this case, that appellate counsel on direct review testified in post-conviction that his ability to meaningfully represent Mr. Ben-Yisrael was hindered by the state of this record. You also have post-conviction counsel in its briefs saying likewise. They couldn't identify all issues for appeal because of the state of this record. And indeed, you have the district court in this case saying it had difficulty resolving the issue of the case because of the inadequacy of the record. I might add myself, I felt I had ethical obligation to read the entire transcript, and I can tell you that there are portions that I found to be inaccurate, incomplete, and I wasn't able to perhaps then understand completely what happened at trial. The Supreme Court in Dobbs versus Zant noted that it had, quote, emphasized before the importance of reviewing capital sentences on a complete record, end quote. No man should be executed on the basis of this deficient record. Nothing in Dobbs requires a petitioner to demonstrate detailed prejudice, and the Indiana Supreme Court unreasonably concluded that Mr. Ben-Yisrael was required to make specific allegations of error. And again, the three issues that were not addressed in this case by the district court, we spoke about previously, the Fleming issue and the unreasonable delay, and then also the admission of the Blavsky evidence. We believe that the admission of that extrinsic evidence was fundamentally unfair and deprived Mr. Ben-Yisrael of due process.
Now, they properly objected to all that and everything in the record there.
As we explained in our brief, none of those issues have been procedurally defaulted. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Huggins.